to kick off our bull sessions for the season, I have Anna Bongiorno and Judd Rogers from Scout Clean Energy here to talk about wind and solar projects. And so I'm not going to say much. I think they'll do better at explaining their company and introducing themselves. So I'm just going to let them take it away.
Awesome. Thanks, Holly. All right. Well, thank you so much to everybody for joining us this evening. As Holly mentioned, my name is Anna, and I'm a senior project manager with Scout Clean Energy. And then with me today, I also have Judd Rogers. Judd is a development director at Scout Clean Energy. And so Judd will be helping to kind of monitor the chat as well and chime in if there's anything else that needs to be added. But today the plan is really to talk about renewable energy and working lands and agricultural lands and ranching lands, speak a little bit to how wind and solar development work, what income structures might look like for wind and solar leases, and how renewable energy can be complementary to sustainable ranching and agricultural practices. I'm going to try to keep this presentation at about 30 minutes or less, and then I'll ask that folks save most of their questions to the end, and I think we'll have about 15 minutes for Q&A then. So who is Scout Clean Energy? Who do Judd and I work for? Kind of why are we talking to you all today? We're a Colorado-based company that's been around since about 2016, although most of our management team has really been working together since the early 2000s or so. We really started as a wind energy company and have operational projects right now in Texas, Oklahoma, Indiana, and California, and more recently have also been working on a number of solar projects. So we have our first solar projects that are about to start construction in Texas and Indiana here in the next year or so. Judd and I both work for Scout's new projects team. So we're really focused on working with landowners and communities to get projects off the ground in the very earliest stages. We're really here to figure out how to develop projects that can be beneficial to landowners and beneficial to communities. Scout is essentially what's called a developer, or sometimes an IPP, an independent power producer. So we're different from utilities that might build and own power plants. We actually build different power generating facilities and then sell that power to those utilities, or we can also sell power sometimes to private companies or government entities. So we develop utility scale wind, solar, and storage projects. And utility scale is a term that's really used to describe projects that connect to the high voltage electrical transmission grid. There's a couple of other types of mainly solar development, really one called distributed generation, which really focuses on smaller transmission lines and it's smaller scale projects. And then you have things like rooftop solar developers that are the folks that will sell or lease panels to then put on your house or maybe out in your yard. So we work really in the utility scale, which is often fairly large projects. So you can see on this slide, we have 20 operational projects, 1.2 gigawatts in operation, and that's really just a reference to the size of the projects. 23 states that we're actively developing projects in, and over 15 gigawatts of projects in development. So we definitely have a lot going on. I just wanted to put Scout's mission up here. So our mission focuses pretty heavily on cost competitive solutions to issues like climate change, air pollution, energy security in the United States, and rural economic development. And part of the reason that renewables are really growing so rapidly right now across the country is because they can often produce more affordable energy than a lot of traditional fuel sources. And then the rural economic development benefits are also key because a lot of the main benefits that renewable energy projects have include significant revenue to landowners as well as communities through things like lease payments and tax payments. So this is just a photo of our Colorado office team. So we've worked on a number of wind, solar, and storage projects across the country. Right now, a lot of our work is really concentrated in the Midwest and in the Western United States. We've worked with thousands of landowners across the country, main landowners that are agricultural users, ranchers, as well as farm managers and other companies. And we enter into long-term lease agreements with them to develop projects on their property. So I wanted to spend some time talking about the process of developing wind and solar projects. I'm going to provide an overview, and this overview would really be relevant to any company completing work similar to Scout. So this is kind of our process, but most developers that are like us follow a very similar process. Both wind and solar projects really have three periods: a development period, a construction period, and an operations period. So these three periods would be reflected in a lease that a landowner might sign with a development company. During the development period, which is the first period, the landowner continues to use their property as they normally would while we're conducting basically studies. While a lot of these studies can be completed in a relatively short amount of time, maybe 3 to 4 years, some of the studies that take the longest are with the utility. So the utility in an area that might own a transmission line is what we're trying to connect a project to. And they'll have to study our proposed project in a couple of different phases and really let us know what type of costs or issues might come up if we want to connect that project to the grid. And then because there's been a pretty significant rise in renewables in the past decade or so, those processes can take quite a long time because there's a lot of projects to study. And I'll talk a little bit more about the development period here in a couple of slides. The construction period is the next period that often takes 1 to 2 years for both utility scale wind and solar projects. For wind projects, that really includes a lot of foundation excavation for building the turbines, the actual delivery and assembly of a large turbine, laying cables in the ground to connect the turbines, and then constructing roads that go throughout the project. For solar projects, it's a little bit different. There might be some grading to level the site if that's needed for the project. There's a fence that gets set up around the project and roads that are constructed. And then steel piles are driven into the ground. And that's what the panels are actually mounted on top of. There's also some cabling as well in the solar projects. And then the operations period is the last period, and this is the longest. So it's a lot of times in leases now, anywhere from 40 to 50 years. And at that point, there's really not a ton happening on a property or project area other than a project producing power. That's kind of one of the great things about renewables. Once they're up and running, they really don't require much maintenance. There might be some mowing on solar panels to keep vegetation low, some washing of panels if dust is accumulating on them. But most of our team's job at that point is ensuring that payments are made on time, permits are maintained, and the reports are being sent to the right entities. So the site also continues to be optimized in different ways. And then there might be some marketing of additional power for purchase. So I'm going to run through the development process for a wind project, but this would be very similar for solar. A lot of them go through the same or very similar sets of studies. So all projects really start off with what we call site selection. And there are a number of things that have to come together for a site to work. The big things that we really look at are resource. So where is the wind blowing? How much sun is shining in an area? Other things include access to a transmission line. So are you maybe within 5 to 10 miles of a high voltage line? What are the environmental or engineering conditions of a site? Like whether there are wetlands or floodplains present, whether there might be some sort of threatened or endangered species habitat, if there are pipelines or other infrastructure, railroads crossing the properties, and then what the topography of the site looks like. There's not a ton that can really preclude a project from being built on a site, but a lot of the factors really impact the cost of construction. And that can be a big determinant of a successful project. Once we've found an ideal site, we'll start reaching out to landowners in the area that we think might be interested in leasing their land. If they are, we'll provide them with a lease agreement and then work to finalize that lease. So getting this interest from folks can really be one of the most challenging parts of development. All of our agreements are completely voluntary. So you have to get agreement from everyone that would be necessary to participate in the project that they want to be involved. For solar projects, this is usually around 1,000 contiguous acres to make a project work in the utility scale market. And for wind projects, it's often closer to 10,000 acres. So it's a pretty significant amount of land and quite usually multiple folks that have to be on board with wanting to put a project on their property. Then there are also a couple of other items that need to be in place when we are siting a project. We have here a favorable local energy policy. And for us, that means that there is a path forward to permit a wind or solar project in the county and in the state. It's a little bit different everywhere. Some states have expedited permitting processes to help promote renewable development in an area. In other areas, there might be counties that have enacted restrictions on things like wind turbine height or spacing that really prevent a project from being viable there. Most of the time, we avoid a lot of those areas if they've passed those types of restrictions, but sometimes there's opportunities to work with folks and maybe make adjustments to their ordinances or zoning plans if that's something that a community is open to. The other thing that we look for really is good power transmission. So I mentioned this big challenge with kind of the timing of the studies that the utilities do. Kind of going along with that, it's also challenging to find a place where projects can connect to the grid without it being too expensive or causing too many issues. When we connect a wind or solar project to the grid, we have to pay for that connection and for any upgrades that are necessary to kind of make room for or accommodate a project. And that can really be one of the largest expenses outside of our actual construction costs. At Scout, we work with a lot of different consultants, and they help us study transmission lines really across the country. And we try to identify some areas where costs might be reasonable. So then moving into development, once we have a majority of the land secured to build a project, we also need to ensure we have land for things like transmission lines. So I mentioned you might have a site that is 5 to 10 miles away from a transmission line. We'd have to secure easements between a project area and that line to be able to connect it to the grid. And a lot of times that means, you know, quite a few more landowners that you're working with to get that project connected to the grid. We'll also approach the local jurisdiction to begin that permitting process. The main permit that we get for wind and solar projects is typically a special use permit at the county level, but it can really be dependent on different local ordinances. Counties or townships in some regions often require us to complete a number of different studies to ensure that the project has minimal or manageable impact on an area. And then there can be other agreements besides the permit that we might have to negotiate with them. Sometimes that's tax agreements, whether that's incentives or providing some certainty on long-term tax payments, road use agreements, particularly for wind projects where heavy equipment could be going down county roads, and other agreements that a specific county might require based on their needs. We also complete similar permitting with state and federal agencies. So Scout, as a company, is very committed to responsible development. And that means that we want to ensure that we aren't negatively impacting things like wetlands or waterways or sensitive habitats or cultural resources. To ensure we're not doing that, it all requires pretty detailed studies to be completed on the properties that are being involved in a project. And then our plans for development are submitted to agencies for review and consultation, and then ideally eventual approval. While we're completing those different kind of local and environmental permitting phases, we're also looking at different stages of design on the project to understand what will the layout look like. We'll look at things like hydrology on the site and geotechnical characteristics. We'll try to figure out where is going to be the best place on a property to place actual wind turbines and solar panels. And once we have that figured out, Scout's construction team works with construction contractors to get a construction bid for the project. And then the final step here is finding financing for the project. So Scout has worked with a number of long-term financing partners to provide funds to build the project. And that's really the last step before we start construction. So construction could be a two-year process where landowners start receiving larger lease revenue as construction on the project begins. There can be environmental and engineering surveys that have been completed, and design has really already optimized that layout. So that construction process includes some of the items that I mentioned before. For wind projects, that's excavating foundations, assembling turbines, laying cables, constructing roads. For solar, I'd mentioned there's grading, setting up fences, driving the piles and mounting the panels. A lot of the economic benefits to communities can be realized at this stage because there'll be a can be a pretty sizable construction team that are staying in local housing, eating in local restaurants, and then ideally local services are also being employed to help construct the project. And then once that construction is completed, again, it's that 1 to 2 year period, then the project is operational. So for solar projects, those are then mainly managed remotely, and you'll have a regional employee that comes to the site to complete some maintenance. And then for wind projects, there's a permanent operations building that gets built on site. And that usually has a couple of full-time staff that are there to keep everything working as it should on the wind project. So then the next thing I wanted to talk about is the income structures. Now that we have kind of an overview of these development, construction, and operations period, what does the income for a landowner look like at these different stages? I'm going to start with a wind project because that can often be a little bit more complicated. And then we'll also take a look at solar projects. And I'll mention, I know there's a few folks on the call that have renewable energy projects on their land. So I'll speak to some rates that Scout has seen or kind of what is currently being offered, but certainly can't speak to folks that might already be signed up with different companies. I also wanted to chat a little bit about how rates are determined because they do vary pretty widely across the country. So rates are often a function of three different things. First is just the underlying value of the land and the revenue that might be available to a landowner from the uses of the land. The second is the price that power can be sold at a region. And so power prices can also vary pretty broadly across the country. And then the final one, and this one's important, is it's really the constructability of a site. So, you know, if a property is flat and clear and close to a transmission line, then there might be higher lease rates because construction costs can be lower for that project. But if a property has challenging topography or lots of wetlands and it might cost more to build, rates might go up. So those are the three main things that we look at when determining rates. Our goal really is to offer landowners on wind projects a reliable way of diversifying their income. And then with solar, our goal is really to be competitive with rates that they would receive from agricultural or other revenue since we're taking up more of the land. Wind turbines usually only take up about 1 acre per turbine. So that's the actual footprint of the turbine itself. And that's, you know, one turbine in maybe 100, and that's across that larger 10,000 acres. But then solar projects are much denser, and they typically cover a majority of a landowner's property that they're wanting to lease to a developer to build a project. So in the development period, landowners are able to continue to use their land as they currently are. So we're typically paying a smaller dollar per acre per year amount, really just for the option to study the property. And then if everything checks out, we can elect to go forward with the construction of the project. So this payment is really seen as supplemental to a landowner's current income. And it ranges, as I mentioned, based on location and value of the land and constructability. For wind projects in the US, we're seeing this payment range anywhere from $4 to $20 per acre per year. We're seeing those highest rates typically in the Midwest where you have very high value farm ground. Just so for example, we're seeing things probably in the lower half of this range in the Western United States right now. Just as an example, if you had 1,000 acres that you leased for projects and the development period payment was $5 per acre per year, you'd be making an additional $5,000 per year while you make income from other uses on the property. The other point here is a met tower payment. So for wind projects, a lot of times a meteorological tower has to be erected to measure the specific wind resource on the property before a project can be developed. And those are usually a flat payment per tower per year. A lot of times those might range from $500 to $2,000. Then the construction payments are made based off of impacts to the land. For wind projects, you see this typically taking two forms. One is a dollar per turbine amount, and the other is a dollar per megawatt amount. So the dollar per megawatt amount is a little bit funky because a turbine is basically rated on a megawatt basis. I think a lot of the turbines that are constructed right now are probably 3 to 4 megawatt turbines or smaller. But in the future, because the technology is improving pretty rapidly, they project being able to have 6-7 megawatt turbines. These are able to generate more electricity in the same amount of land, but sometimes they can be taller or a little bit larger. So a lot of landowners are opting for this dollar per megawatt structure now because it ensures that they're being compensated if these more efficient or larger turbines are being placed on their property. A lot of times we're seeing these rates range from about $2,000 to $5,000 per megawatt. So for example, if you have 1,000 acres, that could be anywhere from 5 to 10 turbines that get placed on your land. Let's say you had 10 turbines and those are 5 megawatt turbines paid at $2,000 a megawatt. That would be a payment of $100,000 when construction occurs on the property. There's also a road, cable, and transmission fee. And so that's for the impact when people are building access roads to the turbines, or if they're having to put cable on your property to connect turbines to one another. Typically that's underground. And that's just paid per linear foot of impact. It's usually just a few dollars. So it's a bit more minimal. But in that case, if a road or cabling area is built across your property, you'll also receive payment for that. The last one is the operations payment, and this is where most of the actual revenue is for a landowner in a wind lease. There's two main frameworks that are used. The first uses that kind of dollar per turbine or dollar per megawatt structure that I mentioned for the construction period. And similarly, most landowners opt to go with a dollar per megawatt payment, since we see those turbine sizes continue to increase. That again is in that $3,000 to $5,000 per megawatt average, particularly in the Western US. So if we can continue with the 10 turbines as an example, that could be anywhere from $150,000 to $250,000 per year on a property. And then that's escalating a lot of times to keep up with inflation. The second framework that's used is what's called a royalty payment. And this fluctuates depending on the income that the project is actually receiving. And it's a percentage of the revenue that that project is getting from selling the power. Some landowners prefer that structure because they can capture upside if the revenue of a project increases. But a lot of landowners kind of prefer that certainty of a dollar per megawatt payment so they know what they're getting in the long term. Operation revenue, we're typically seeing that anywhere from 3 to 6%. So at current power prices, that would probably be closer to $100,000 a year if we're sticking with that 1,000 acres, 10 turbines example. So solar is a little bit more straightforward. Since we're using contiguous land and really preventing other leasing opportunities, solar is paid at a lease rate of just a dollar per acre per year. In the development period, because we are eventually using more of the land, those payments for solar are typically $10 to $20 per acre per year. And sometimes those increase, you know, through that 4 to 6 year period. So if you were to lease 1,000 acres for a solar project, that would be $10,000 a year just to give a developer the option to study the land. And similar to wind, that's also supplemental to the current income. So during that development period, they can continue to farm the land or lease it out to a tenant, whatever that current use is. Then during the construction period, once that starts, the project really takes over kind of exclusive use of the land. A fence gets erected, and then most of what's happening within that is all for the development of the solar project. At that point, because the landowner can't use the land anymore for farming or leasing or ranching, it's a $250 to a $600 per acre per year payment. So again, for 1,000 acres, that would be about $250,000 per year for construction. Then in the operations period, once the project is up and running, that rent is anywhere from $400 to even $1,000 per acre per year, really depending on where the project is located. And again, we're seeing those higher values, mainly in the Midwest, a lot in kind of Iowa and Indiana, where the price of land is higher. So for 1,000 acres at maybe $400 a year, that's $400,000 per year that a landowner is receiving. And then that is also escalating annually to keep, you know, generally to keep up with inflation. So part of the reason we've been talking with the Western Sustainability Exchange is that sustainable agriculture and sustainable energy are really two sides of the same coin. So I wanted to touch on three different ways that renewables and ranching can really be kind of complementary to one another. The first is income diversification. So that's the main benefit that we work with landowners on, is diversifying their income and really helping to ensure that these working lands can remain in families for generations to come. In the past, you know, the U.S. has seen, and still today, you know, the U.S. is seeing pretty volatile commodity prices. There's lots of changing weather patterns, including precipitation. There's been introductions of pests and just other unpredictable things like this that can really negatively affect income for landowners. So with things like renewable energy on working lands, that can help mitigate some of that risk and provide a reliable and long-term source of income for folks. With wind projects, the turbines are really just taking up a fraction of the available land while also providing substantial annual revenue to folks. A lot of the landowners that we work with on wind projects continue their ranching or their farming along with the wind farm. So they're really just adding that significant income without significantly reducing the amount of land that they're able to utilize. Solar projects take up quite a bit more land. So in those cases, we often work with landowners that are looking to convert a significant portion of their land to solar. But on the flip side, this provides most folks with long-term passive income, and it requires very little additional effort on the part of the landowners. The second piece here is land improvements. So renewable energy projects are really held to a pretty high standard of environmental protection. So we try to minimize any impacts to things like wetlands or habitat. As part of that development process that I mentioned earlier, we complete environmental assessments, wetland delineations, and a lot of other studies to help understand the environmental profile of a property. There's additional benefits when we reseed areas that might be disturbed during construction with things like native vegetation that can help prevent erosion and support carbon sequestration. We also work with landowners on solar projects to actually enable them to capture benefits from things like pollinator credits or carbon credits while a solar project is on their property. And then the final item here is really benefits for rural and agricultural communities. This primarily comes through tax benefits and from construction jobs. So these projects represent a pretty significant infrastructure investment in communities, and that can serve as a very large source of tax revenue for a community. We've seen that money get used for things like schools and roads and hospitals, all while we're not placing an additional strain on those services because there's not a massive influx of permanent long-term workers. There's also ample jobs available during construction though. So often you see anywhere from 100 to 500 construction workers per project, and then a couple of full-time jobs available during operation. There's also a lot of opportunities for things like training of the local workforce. And then there's indirect benefits through local spending and partnerships. Developers like Scout are really focused on being long-term partners to communities. And, you know, our goal is to be able to participate in and support lots of community events throughout the life of the project. So really to summarize, you know, renewable energy is a great opportunity to continue the sustainable use of working lands while also providing long-term revenue to landowners. I've listed a number of resources here, and we can circulate these via email after the call. I think a lot of these can be kind of beneficial to answering questions about renewable energy on working lands. So I'll make sure that we can get those out to folks. And then I know Holly has spoken to a few folks that are in Western Sustainability Exchange about providing testimonials about having renewable energy on their property. So I will turn it over to Holly to introduce those folks.
Thank you, Anna. And it looks like we're getting a lot of questions in the chat. So just hold those thoughts, people. So we have Kevin Halverson and Sven Svensson from the Big Timber area, and they have a wind farm on their property. And we can just, I'll just have them kind of explain their experiences through the whole, you know, development and construction and, you know, that their feelings now about the project. So I guess, Sven, I'll let you start and then we'll have Kevin wrap it up.
Okay. Maybe I'll, because, you know, it took us 18 years to get this project up and going. It was back and forth, and this is on and off, and just a lot of bull, so to say. But yeah, I'm tickled to death. We got it done. You know, like I said, 18 years. But during construction, yeah, the whole ranch looked like a war zone. But when they got done, it looked like a city park. And you know, there was up to 150 people working here at one time. And that they probably started building roads November of 17 and got the project completed in October of 18. You know, me and Kevin have two power lines running through our property, a 160 kV line and a 230 kV line. So they hooked into the 230 kV line and built a substation. And then they built the O&M yard just a couple miles north of there, for, you know, easy access off the county road. And I think there is 4 to 5 permanent employees with the project. Also, there is the with Pattern Energy is our company, and they use the Siemens turbines. And off and on, they have crews from Pattern and Siemens to come in and maintain and update the turbines. And you know, I think it's just a win-win no matter what. You know, I can still graze my cattle, sheep, and goats right under the turbine. There's wildlife right under the turbine. It doesn't affect any of that at all. And we did have one little hiccup when we started. They found a golden eagle's nest. They had to move 3 turbines so they was, you know, away from the eagle's nest at least 1.5 miles, but at least they stayed on my property, which is a good thing. Another thing I think Anna talked about was the revenue. You could either do a dollar per megawatt, or go with the gross production. And Kevin and I decided to go with so many dollars per megawatt instead of the production side, because we get paid the same whether the wind blows or not. Else to say, if Kevin's got any comments, can fill in. I'd appreciate that.
Yeah, this is Kevin. I think Anna done a real good job of explaining. I mean, you need a good site. You need transmission and you need wind, and it takes all of the above to make it work. And it takes a while to get stuff accomplished. There's archaeology studies to do and avian studies to do, and they have to resurvey all your land to make sure they're paying the right people. And in our clause, we have a escalating clause, so that the power of energy goes up per megawatt, we get whatever the percentage that went up, we get that added percentage. I think Anna's prices were a little more inflated than what ours are, but we are in native range ground, so that makes quite a bit of difference on what you're getting paid. As far as domestic livestock, we got cow patties right in the gravel and in the place right around the turbines. And you know, to start with, when we were trailing cows home, we had to trail by another wind farm, and the livestock would kind of shy and block at it. But it was not so much the wind turbine, it was cattle that was swinging by there. It was scaring them. It doesn't take very long, and wildlife is, I think, the first 2 or 3 years with the turbines, the elk population, it kind of disappeared. But last week, one of our friends stuck a 6-point bull a quarter of a mile from one of the turbines, so they're back there. I mean, we find way more sheds now than we did when they first put the turbines up. So as far as wildlife, they're going to get used to it, because they do make some noise. You can hear them.
Yeah, but the wind's really got to be blowing if it's going to make noise. Just a general average day, you can hardly hear them. I hear the cranes at Reed Point more than I do the turbines. But, you know, I've even had sheep, if it was a, you know, real hot day, I've had sheep lay in the shade of the turbine, and it even fan out with the blades of the turbine, you know, the 3 points. It's quite hilarious to watch something like that. But, you know, livestock and wildlife, you have no issues with it anymore.
The one thing about if you have a dead animal close to the turbines, they will probably ask you to move the dead animal so that you're not drawn in raptors. That is a big no-no.
I've moved several of them. But we're also dealing with mountain lions and bears in this country.
I was going to add, I think the companies work very well with the landowners, right? I mean, if you have a specific concern, it will be addressed, right? I mean, because I know we signed a contract just like a few months ago, and our concern is it's off a county road. And, you know, once those other roads go to the turbines, it's just going to promote more people leaving the county road to go off and hunt. So the company that we're dealing with says, you know, we can write pretty much anything we want into that contract. Is, you know, if they have to fence those roads off and put like gates so that people can't drive down, they are willing to do that. So I'm assuming that's kind of industry standard.
For the most part, you know, a lot of it is kind of analyzing that cost and what impact it has on the project. But a lot of things like that are very manageable and easy to address folks' concerns. So that's our goal, is to be a good partner. You know, it's not just a 1 to 2 year thing. These projects can, you know, with all the different development and construction, they can be 50 plus years. And so the goal is to create a good relationship and a deal that's good for everybody.
They were asked in the chat while you were presenting that it would be good to address.
Yeah, do you want me to take those or do you want to address them?
Yeah, I'll read them off and we can tap on together. There's definitely some interest from a couple people about kind of the symbiotic relationship between continuing agriculture at a solar project and, you know, what could work with the arrays, whether you can graze cattle or other agricultural practices. And I can speak to that a little bit, or if you want to touch on that as well. Yeah, so, you know, this is kind of a emerging practice, and, you know, there's a lot of groups, I would say kind of at the smaller scale right now, that are really trying to understand some of these synergies. I haven't seen too many kind of scalable examples of cattle with solar projects, both just in terms of the size and the potential for damage that they could do at a facility. What I've seen it's really starting to emerge is sheep. They're you know, great grazing. They don't necessarily pose a risk to the infrastructure. A lot of times people ask about goats, and goats are really great climbers and chewers. And so they've been seen to be able to actually climb up on the panels or the racking systems or chew through cables or wires. But what seems to be really proving itself out is sheep. On that level. And then Anna also mentioned the potential for pollinators and other species planting native grasses, potentially getting credits for that. The other one I've seen is, you know, bees as well. And Anna, I don't know if you have any other examples you've seen that have been able to be utilized at an operating project.
No, that's mainly it. And I know, you know, a lot of this has kind of been in the research stage and it's just now getting to implementation. And so a lot of it will start with the study at a smaller project. And then once they can figure out how to make it economical, it gets expanded to bigger projects. So I know, as Jed mentioned, the kind of sheep grazing is in that transition right now from those small scale projects to larger scale projects. And then there's also a lot of other studies being done on, you know, are there crops that can be grown under arrays that prevent from maybe a more shaded area? So a lot of that is being experimented on, and hopefully we'll be able to be kind of rolled out to larger scale projects in the coming years.
There's a question about whether Scout's done any solar work in Montana, particularly in Northwestern Energy Service area. I can address that if you'd like as well. And I guess before we go on to that, someone asked about poultry. And, you know, that's another one that I haven't seen anything that's been scaled. I've certainly seen at the smaller scale, you know, Anna had talked about the kind of distribution level or community solar gardens where they're really playing around with this, but I haven't seen it at the scale of projects that we develop, but it certainly is something that I'm seeing at a smaller scale. In terms of the work that we've done currently in Montana and Northwestern Energy Territory, we have one active wind development that we're working on. It is a Northwestern Energy Service area, but it's actually targeting a line, the Colstrip line. Some of you might be aware of the large Colstrip coal-fired power plant that's due to be retired. That power ultimately ends up in the Pacific Northwest, and it's owned by several utilities in the Pacific Northwest. And so we're targeting that line because essentially that pipe, that transmission line, is going to have capacity as they retire that coal plant. So we're working on a project in the 2DOT area of Montana, and that's been in the works for a couple of years. We've got quite a bit of land leased, and as I mentioned, we're going through all the development processes right now, studying the bats and the birds, and really understanding kind of what the constraints are of that project and how we can move that power. The relationship that we've had with Northwestern Energy on that project has really been on the interconnection side. They're involved with doing some of the interconnection studies, but they're not really our target customer. So to date, we don't necessarily have any experience working directly with Northwestern Energy on kind of offtake in Montana. I do know that they have some goals to be carbon free by 2050, and you know that's pretty far out on the horizon. There's some other utilities that are taking a little bit more ambitious steps to move a little bit quicker. But those kind of goals and or mandates that they're putting on themselves will certainly necessitate more wind and solar projects in their service territories over the coming years. Minimum acreage that's necessary to make a solar development economical.
Yeah, I'm happy to.
I can answer that while you figure it out. But yeah, we can't. So the minimum acreage we often use for solar, about 5 acres per megawatt. It's kind of the rule of thumb that we start with. If you're dealing with relatively flat, unencumbered land, no wetlands or other features you have to avoid, 5 acres per megawatt is a good number to start from. And so I think Anna mentioned at the utility scale level, we try to work on projects that are 100 megawatts and above. And so you're talking about a minimum of 500 acres, but that could certainly go up into the thousands of acres depending on the magnitude of the project.
Yeah, so Sven has something to add really quick.
Okay.
Yeah, no, it takes 5 acres of solar. Our solar energy takes 5 acres to generate 1 acre.
Well, on our project, we had 6 landowners in, I don't know, there must have been 20,000 acres. I wouldn't mind adding is the community effect when you start looking at the amount of tax base that you're putting into the community. It definitely improves your county roads and your schools and your hospital. It's got a little 14 tower turbine farm just north of me. And I think when they got that finished, they become the 4th largest taxpayer in Sweetgrass County. My Northwest Energy, Stillwater Mine, and Montana Rail Link. So,
yep.
They're a big producer of tax dollars.
Yeah.
Yeah, but did they get a tax abatement on Sweetgrass County?
I'm sure they did, yes.
Anna, did you have something to add to that?
No, I was just going to say, you know, that's certainly, in my opinion, one of the biggest benefits of renewable projects is that tax revenue to these counties. And a lot of times we're seeing it in places like, you know, such as the Colstrip mine that's being shut down. You have other tax revenue that's coming in to ideally replace, you know, something that was sustaining a community for a long time. We do negotiate tax incentives with different counties and taxing jurisdictions, but a lot of that is to provide some long-term certainty for both parties, because the tax rates and the tax methodology can change over time. So we look to get an agreement in place that says, you know, at least for the next 10 to 20 years, we're both on the same page of what's going to be paid and what the county is going to receive. And it helps both parties plan a lot better financially.
Cool. So anybody else have questions besides in the chat? Okay.
I saw Mark had another comment in the chat about the minimum solar project size. So that's for Scout, it's usually about 600 buildable acres, and that often means having a little bit more than that so that we can set back from wetlands or roads or things like that. So I usually tell folks 600 is the bare minimum. We're typically targeting closer to 1,000 acres. But that doesn't always have to be with just one landowner. You know, a lot of our projects, particularly in, you know, Illinois or Wisconsin, we're working with 20 landowners on some of these solar projects because everybody's just has 50 acres or 100 acre tracts.
So Anna, on that, so if there are like several landowners, does it literally have to be like connecting acreage? Like it's got to be like, you know, your corner, I mean, or can you, is there some division? Because you probably have to put fences around each of those, right? So you would probably prefer that it all be in one spot, but can it be broke up a little bit?
So it can be separated, but we'll still have to connect it electrically. So if say you have, you know, two parcels and one landowner in between those parcels that isn't on board, we'd still have to get an easement across their property to lay electrical line to be able to connect the two sets of panels electrically. So the preference is, and you know, it's more economical and you get lower construction costs if you can do it all as one contiguous area. But there's certainly sites where we've had to kind of piece a couple different areas together before.
And is that the same with like hills and valleys? Like if you probably can't do, you know, a lot of different terrain on a solar farm, but is there, you know, is that kind of where you have to break it up as well?
Yes. And it kind of depends on the landowner. Well, how much land we're having to leave out and kind of what the landowner's preferences are. Say there's like a 2 or 3 acre section in a project that's has pretty hilly topography that we can't build on. Usually, oftentimes it might be more economical for us to build on either side of the hill, but then fence all the way around it and just pay the lease rate on that 2 acres rather than try to fence it out and leave that land. And then it also depends, you know, we work pretty closely with the landowners to see, do they have use for that land? If it's not included in something like a solar project, what would, you know, because we don't want to like orphan any acreage that is not usable for them or island anything or just leave, you know, we're not trying to leave like an acre here, an acre there that's not used in the project. Any other questions from folks?
No, I just got one more comment. Was it you, Holly, that was talking about the access roads, these wind turbines that the general public was maybe going to try to use them for hunting and recreation?
Right.
On our wind site, it is strictly forbidden. Anybody that goes in has to stop at the O&M yard. And even on my ranch, the wind farm employees have, the only rights they have is to drive on the roads and around the turbines and to the substation. They don't have any rights to go drive around to my cows, my pasture, or go hunting or stuff like that. And neither does the public. You know, that's a private road and a private entity.
And it's something that we, and I know everybody that we work with takes very seriously. So there's a lot of restrictions that folks, you know, often can't even have guns or ammunition and vehicles, anything hunting or fishing related, just to prevent any sort of temptation, but also just not to have any confusion, you know, so folks are just really going there to work and be on the project and not taking advantage of anybody's property.
It is a question that's brought up a lot on how hunting and wind farms can coexist. And certainly during the construction period, hunting is prohibited, obviously for safety reasons. Depending on the magnitude of the footprint of the project, there's been instances where, you know, if the project spans, you know, tens of miles, you could potentially, and you're basically just doing construction in one part of the project, you can isolate areas for hunting. And then during the operating period, there's not a ton of restrictions. It's really just the communication with the operations team and just making sure that whoever's on the property hunting has made themselves aware and that there's just good communication. But these are all protocols that can be put in to allow guests to come on to the property that are obviously allowed by the landowner. But those two can coexist. And I've had discussions with a lot of folks and more in the kind of Pennsylvania where they see the roads, the access roads as a shooting lane that they didn't have in the past. You know, in the West, there's a little bit more open open range, but they were very happy with having places where they could actually use their scope a little bit more to have shooting lanes for the deer that they're hunting for. Wasn't something that I had thought about as being a a side benefit.
Can I throw a couple questions out?
Betcha.
My name is Mark Suda, and I live in Cutbank, Montana, and basically surrounded by Nat Rainer's wind farm and lots of experiences, good and bad. You know, I could go on for probably hours, but I guess the one of the questions I have is the marketing and selling of the power. Do you, as Scout Energy, do that, or is there a company that you have that does that? The biggest drawback we had, they built phase one, the power was sold to San Diego Public Power for a fairly good price. And they said, hey, let's build phase two. And our electric rates dropped, you know, electricity fell out of bed here several years ago. And the power going into the grid has never been sold off of phase two. So we get paid, and we took a percentage share, you know, 3% of the gross revenue taken off that generator would be mine. Well, they never sold the power. And electricity rates in the last, oh, I don't know, up until the last couple of years have been practically 0 to 1 cent to minus 1 cent. To all sorts of things. So they promised us these big projects, big checks, and what, you know, but there is a minimum on the contract. Well, whenever a company has a minimum on the contract, that's just about what you can expect to get is the minimum that's on that contract. And that's all we've got in the since this phase two has been built. And it leaves kind of a foul taste in your mouth because you give the presentation of what you can make, but then, oh, we didn't quite get it sold. Well, that power is still going into the grid. That power is going somewhere. Somebody's making something off of that, but it's definitely not the landowner. And it leaves kind of a sad taste in your mouth because of that. They're not going anywhere. We have great expectations of someday being better. Now that the electric rates are in, I guess I'm hoping everybody buys an electric car so the cost of electricity that we have to buy goes up so that our rates and we can get paid better. But to me, that's the biggest problem. We had literally no problems with the people coming in here, putting the generators up, putting the roads in, you know, fairly good experience. We still have some weed issues and some problems with the group, but there's 22 people working out of the O&M building up here. So, you know, the community impact of just people going to work is one of the best things that we have. They had problems such as Native Heritage and the Indian rings. They had to go around all the Indian rings that were on the ridges that they wanted to put a road in or put a tower on. And so they had a team of Native Americans walking around scouting the area to find a place where they could go. And it hampered it quite a bit and in a good way, kind of. You know, back in the homesteader days, they just plowed the ground up and picked the rocks. So good or bad, you take it however you want. Up in this area, they had a big problem with the raptors and the birds. And you can go to Naturainer's website or Naturainer, however they say it, and look at what they've done for the raptors and the birds, controlling their movements. If they have stations up here that will see a hawk, and it will shut down generators as that hawk runs in that pattern. And it's really cool to see what they do, but it's not very good to have somebody out here, oh, these things kill birds. You know, I've combined underneath these and watched a hawk kill the whole entire flock of huns go up and come back down right underneath the generator. And that hawk didn't care that generator was there. So there again, you have good and bad. One of the other things that the state of Montana has an environmental impact statement, I believe, that has to be done if you go on state grounds. Up in this area, they just skipped all the state ground. They said, well, we don't want to take that time, so we're just not going to do it on state land. And a school section could have had two or three wind generators on it, and that money going directly to a school system up in this area would have benefited a lot better than just going around it, because we don't want to do the environmental impact statement. So the company and they should have worked a little better. And I don't know how that would be with the state now. Maybe I'm going through this kind of fast, but believe there now there's a bonding issue that you have to be bonded, much like an oil well, to where if you change your mind, you've got to clean it up. And I think that passed the legislature here several years ago to go through. Like I said, once the wind generator problem is here, I mean, it's not going anywhere, and it is there for a lifetime, I hope, you know, because it can only get better. Unfortunately, ours are 1.5 megawatts. There's 140 of them in this park and 100 of them north of our place. And those 140, they built the Montana-Alberta tie line to take power up into Canada, because you have to have power lines to take the power away. And there was a lot of people that were 100% for the wind generators to be built, but oh no, you can't build a power line on my ground, you know. So it's kind of funny how people's reaction are or does. So I threw a lot of stuff out at you, but I mean, I could talk for hours on wind farm and whether I feel good or feel bad, but that's kind of the way it is. One of the big things, and I don't know, talking to the other ones, was when this wind farm came in, they talked to each individual landowner and went and created, you know, and we really should have got a landowner group going so that we all had the same field to go on. There was a lot of deals done with different landowners that, you know, and we weren't supposed to talk to them. Well, you talk to your neighbors, you know, and they didn't expect that, I guess. So a landowner group where everybody sits down with somebody who can read contracts better than a bunch of farmers, or better than me anyway, isn't a bad way to go. So if Scout has a person that can step up and deal with the landowners so they're all on a level playing field, that's probably key when you have a lot of landowners. If you're down in an area where you've only got 3 to 5 landowners, you know, they're all going to get together anyway, but have a little more of a group too, so everybody knows what everybody else is doing. So that's kind of mine in a nutshell. How does that sound?
Yeah, no, well, thanks, sir. Thanks for all those comments and questions, Mark. I appreciate it. And it's always good to hear people's experience, because it can differ so much from project to project. And so I took a couple notes, and I'll kind of start back at the beginning and hopefully try to get to everything, but let me know if I'm missing anything, and Jed, feel free to jump in as well. I think your first question was, you know, whether or not Scout markets our power for sale. So we do have a team in Scout that is responsible for finding somebody to purchase the power for our projects. And at least, you know, as far as I know, for all the projects we've worked on, if we don't have somebody to purchase power, our projects are not getting built. And that's the case right now for a lot of projects across the country, is that we want to have that 15 to 20 year revenue contract set up before we can get the loans to actually build the project. There are some projects out there, and this was more so the case with natural gas. It hasn't been as much with renewables, but that you would call a merchant power project. And so they're actually selling power just directly into the market and not necessarily going to like a big corporation or utility to sell their power. There's a lot of risk associated with that, because you're really subject to the ups and downs of power pricing rather than having a rate locked in. But it sounds like that could have been the situation where they were then claiming that they didn't have a contract for electricity. The other thing with wind projects is that because of some of the tax credits that are made available from the government, a lot of wind pricing can dip really low at times and even negative, because you're producing power at a certain dollar per megawatt hour rate, and then you're getting a credit for that. So there are projects that sometimes there's so much wind on the grid that they're actually paying other people to take their power off the grid so that they can claim those tax credits. So that's another kind of weird structure that can happen that can cause some of those pricings to be low. You know, for us, we definitely try to create a revenue structure that's going to be fair for the landowner. And so, you know, having those minimums, but also having those offers for kind of dollar per turbine or dollar per megawatt that aren't subject to the revenue kind of ups and downs. But that definitely sounds like a tough situation.
One other thing to add there too is, Mark, I don't know if in your contract, how they defined the gross revenues associated with how they calculate your royalty payments. And, you know, there's another attribute that has economic value called a REC or a renewable energy credit. And in the leases that we have, you can sell the power, the electrons, but you can also sell the green attribute or the renewable attribute of that. And sometimes they decouple that. So you're actually selling electrons onto the grid, but you're also selling a REC to either the same entity or a different entity that wants to say that a megawatt hour of electrons was generated in a sustainable way, and that there's a renewable energy credit associated with that. And our leases, the royalty payment that we pay accounts for the RECs or the renewable energy credits, as well as any power that's sold onto the grid. And I think that's an important point. And anyone else that's like listening on the call, if they're looking at a royalty-based payment, that they ask that question, because I think it is a thing that should be calculated into whatever your gross revenue payment is. And and then I think just having a reasonable floor as a minimum payment that you're comfortable with, regardless of whether the turbine ever spins, that you're just comfortable that you're going to get a check in the mail.
And so then, you know, some of the other items you mentioned, the risks of Indian heritage sites and raptors and birds, you know, that's certainly something we take a look at, and that those kind of cultural studies can be some of the most extensive studies. You know, it's kind of tough, as you mentioned, that land could have been farmed or developed for a while, and then you go to do a turbine foundation and somebody finds, you know, a piece of pottery or something else, and it can trigger a whole nother set of studies that have to be completed. But it's something that we try to account for when we're planning the projects and make sure that we have appropriate timelines to do those studies and other options if turbine locations need to be moved because of that. The raptors and birds is certainly a big issue as well. And that's why we do a lot of these studies early on. And a lot of that technology, like the kind of the surveys that you mentioned, is really being implemented to try to minimize those impacts. And then your comment on the state grounds and how, you know, so much of the land in the West, right, is just really checkerboarded between private and public lands. And you do see that where developers will skip over those public lands to deal with private landowners. And that's really, you know, twofold. One, the federal and state lands often have different requirements for how they can negotiate a lease. So there are some situations where we might approach them for a lease and then they have to put it out to a competitive bid. And so, you know, if we get outbid by somebody else, then suddenly you have two projects competing there. And then, as you mentioned, the kind of the permitting timelines there can be really long. But we've actually been, you know, Jen and I talk a lot with kind of different state trust lands and different groups that we're trying to help them improve that process and get it to where those lands are more accessible for renewable energy development, because it is, as you mentioned, it's a great revenue source for them. And at that point, you can have it going directly to those state trusts or school districts or other entities. And so a lot of it is just working with them to improve their, maybe the lease agreement that they're working with or their permitting process. And some of that's out of our control, but we're always trying to, you know, have kind of open dialogue and conversations with them to figure out how we can make that process better. You also mentioned some of the bonding requirements. And I know that was something that we didn't touch on very much. And Holly, I saw you just put that question in the chat. And so it's her question, Holly's question was, who pays to dismantle at the end of the equipment life? And so that is really the responsibility of the project. And the way that our lease is structured, and I think most leases now are structured, is that there is what's called a decommissioning or a removal bond. And that is intended to pay for the removal of the equipment, kind of minus any potential salvage value of equipment that is left on the property. And that's put in place kind of at different phases, at different time periods of the project, depending on whether it's solar or wind or kind of who the developer is. But that's really supposed to be a security for the landowner that there is money there in, you know, worst case scenario, if a company were to go under or something were to happen, there's money there for the landowner that's going to ensure that that project is removed. But in a majority of situations, it's just, it would be Scout or whoever a project owner would be on a project that is going to come and pay for that removal. They'll remove all of the equipment, will decompact any roads that the landowner doesn't want left on the property, and kind of ensure that the property is restored to the same working condition that it was before the project was constructed. A lot of times too, now you're seeing different counties and states implement requirements, as it sounds like Montana has, that, you know, it's kind of another level of protection for landowners to ensure that, you know, there's not going to be a situation where folks are just left with a project and kind of nothing to do about it.
So does anybody else have any other questions?
Well, and this is Quinn. I'm just going to say that it's been quite interesting. I've learned quite a lot from everybody. I want to thank you for all your comments. And all I can say is charge on.
Thanks, Ben.
Thank you.
Anna or Jed, do you have anything to add?
Just that, you know, we'll send around our contact information and links to some of the resources. And I know we've got this recorded, but definitely let us know if there's any other questions that come up. We're happy to answer those, happy to share information. So but appreciate all your time and your thoughtful questions and everybody for sticking on and listening.
All right. Thanks, everybody.
Yeah. Thank you for your time, Ben. All your great questions. Appreciate the curiosity and interest.
Yeah.
Thanks, Anna and Jeb. I do appreciate it.
Yeah, have a good evening.